Okay, so this, like I said, is a kind of an overview of the Upanishads. All right, so we're going to start with the very first slide. Those who have paper copies, there might be minor modifications which I did last night, so you know, you might have that. Just minor changes. All right. Now, Upanishad is obviously a Sanskrit word, right? Upanishad. What does it mean? It has several components of the word itself, can be broken into multiple segments. And the main root word is sad, S-A-D, you can call it, okay? And then there are prefixes. There's a prefix called ni, and there's a prefix called upa. So it becomes upa ni sad, but because of the rules of Sanskrit, that sad becomes shad when you combine it with the previous prefix. That's how the rules of Sanskrit are. So it becomes Upanishad. Okay. Sad means to sit down. And Nisad means to sit down attentively, you know, with full attention. Nisad. And Upa, when you add the other prefix Upa means to sit near, close to somebody or following somebody, you know, depends on the context. The prefix Upa can mean multiple things, but here it means near, close to somebody. So the word Upanishad literally means sitting down next to somebody with full attention. That's the literal meaning of the word. The derived meaning is that you're sitting next to a realized teacher who knows what he's doing, who knows what he's talking about. And then you are paying full attention to what he's saying in an effort to learn about the topic that is being discussed. Okay? But then the word has kind of transformed its meaning to actually mean the texts that were being discussed at that time. So the texts that were being discussed, they are now called Upanishads. Even though the literal meaning is just to sit down and listen carefully and then understand what the teacher is saying, but because it was applied to this particular text, so when we say Upanishad, we know exactly this text. It doesn't mean any other text. You get the point? That's how the whole derivation has come along. Okay? Patty, are you too far or you're okay?
I can hear you fine. Yeah.
You're okay? All right. It seems like I have to... You guys can come in closer if you like. And you're also hidden from my view. That's the other thing.
That's only because I'm leaning against the wall.
Okay. Okay, that's all right. Now, Upanishads are a part of a larger volume of texts called the Vedas. Vedas. Okay. What are Vedas? What's the Veda? What are these Vedas? What are these? Anybody?
Text
do for what purpose? What's the content?
Spirituality.
What else is the content of the Vedas?
Science.
Hmm?
Science.
Science?
Yeah.
Of what?
Spiritual science.
Spiritual science, I know, but what else?
Of self.
Right. That's one of it. So that's what we're going to go through now. You know, what these segments of the Vedas are. There are four Vedas. Everyone knows the names. Four Vedas. The oldest and the largest of these Vedas is Rig Veda. Rig Veda. Then there is Yajur Veda, Sama Veda and Atharva Veda. Okay. It's good to hear the names because you might come across them somewhere or the other. And I haven't read the book, this Eknath Ishwaran's book recently. I read it a long time ago, so I don't recall if he mentions all the Vedas in there. Does he?
I don't remember. I read it a few months ago.
Hmm?
In that book, I don't remember because I read it like when we first started.
Okay. It's been a while.
But they're not.
specifically.
They're not mentioned specifically? Okay.
They're mentioned, but...
I see. Okay. It's important to know that, you know, the Upanishads are part of Vedas, okay? So we'll go through the Vedas. And then there are four Vedas. Rig Veda is a collection of mantras which are mostly dedicated to the praise and worship of different gods and deities. You know, in India, everything is a god. Even there's a god of wind, there's a god of fire, there's a god of water, everything is because these are natural resources. They are all given to us through the goodwill of these gods. If the god of water is unhappy with us, no rain. Okay. If the god of wind is unhappy with us, no breeze. That's how they teach us when we grow up in India. That's how we learn all these things, you know. Oh, there's no breeze, I'm so hot, I'm sweating, it temperature is 110 degrees. In India, temperature is 110 degrees random, you know, all the time during summer. So my parents would say, oh, the god of wind is very unhappy, you did something wrong. That's how it goes. So there is a praise and worship and, you know, kind of devotion to all these gods and different deities. And that's pretty much the major part of the initial part of the Rig Veda. There are other things, then it goes into a little more spirituality, like you said. Okay. So that's Rig Veda. Then Yajur Veda is mostly how to perform ritual offerings. So very heavily ritualistic based. Okay. And rituals for everything. You know, there are rituals for getting a good crop, there are rituals for getting how to get 100 cows for your farm, rituals for how to get a son, a daughter, a good husband, a good wife, and, you know, things like good prosperity, etc., etc. How to go to heaven, rituals for everything. All right. Rituals for getting rid of the enemy. Okay. So those are mostly in the Yajur Veda. Sama Veda is nothing but putting the Rig Veda mantras into music. So there is a style of singing that's involved in the mantras, which are very metrical, very beautifully composed in proper meter, so you can, you know, sing them very nicely. So that's all in the Sama Veda. Then Atharva Veda is a kind of a vast collection of different things. How to start a magical spell, you know, how to put somebody under your control, you know, magically. But then it also goes into many different things, herbs and medicines and Ayurveda and different branches of science, even a little bit of introduction to engineering. All that stuff is in the Atharva Veda. Very vast kind of a thing. Now, each of these four Vedas has four sections, each of them. The very first section is called the Samhita, which is just a collection of all the mantras. Okay. Now remember, mantras, when I say mantra, they are actually verses. That means they are put in proper meter and they are proper verses. Okay, so they are the mantras. It's a collection of mantras for different purposes, depending on the text that you're talking about. So Rig Veda has mantras for gods and deities and Yajur Veda, etc., etc., all these things. Then the second part is called Brahmana, and that is a prose version of the explanation of these mantras. Okay, so in a prose format, there is an explanation of all these mantras that were in the Samhita part, the first part. Now then from there on it moves into a little more subtle and more spiritual aspect. The third segment is called Aranyaka. It derives from the word Aranya. Aranya means a forest. Okay? It means a forest. Aranyaka means that you have now done the rituals that are prescribed in the previous segments, and now you want to go deeper. So it tells you a little bit of the significance of these mantras and of these rituals. And then you go there and start meditating on the significance. Go to a forest so that you kind of are isolated from everybody and you are able to devote your time entirely. So that's what Aranyaka is all about. And then finally the Upanishads. Okay, and Upanishads are nothing but pure spiritual, philosophical content of the whole Vedas. So that, and in fact, many of the Upanishads claim that the ritualistic parts are useless, they should not be performed, there is no need to perform them, just go straight to spirituality and all that. So there's a contradiction within the same texts. Okay. But of course, as things go on, people understand that rituals are also very important, because it all depends on the person. You know, what kind of background you have, what kind of understanding you have. There are some people who can only do rituals. They have absolutely no interest in spirituality. They have no interest in philosophy. They don't want to know anything about Atman or Brahman or anything. They just want to do their job and be happy. That's it. And for them, ritual is the best. And that's what most people, 99% of the people end up doing, rituals. That's it. In India, religion means ritualistic worship. They go to a temple, they do their puja, you know, go around in circles. Have any of you visited a Hindu temple?
The one in Morrisville.
Yeah, you should go and visit, you know, occasionally, just to see, get a feel for what the ritual is, you know. Go in the evening at 8 o'clock one day, because every day 8 o'clock they have their ritual to do the puja. You just get a feel for it. And, you know, and ask somebody to explain all these things. You'll get a good feel for what the rituals are. And all these rituals that they do, they are extracted from the initial part of the Vedas, the ritualistic part, in some form or the other. All these rituals. And of course then later texts came on, Puranas and all that. So they also have a lot of these rituals mentioned. Okay? So, that's the basic content of the Vedas. And again, broadly speaking, there are, you know, they always say there are Vedas have two sections, even though we said four of them, but they combine the first two into one, the last two into the second one, and they call it in Sanskrit the names are, the first segment is called the Karma Kanda, and the second segment is called the Jnana Kanda. Kanda is a section. Kanda means a section. Karma means action or ritual. So the first half or the first two portions are called the ritualistic part, and second is the Jnana Kanda. Jnana means wisdom or knowledge. So wisdom part or the philosophical part, that's the second part. Higher knowledge. Okay. So let's continue. Now, what they claim is there are many, probably more than 200 Upanishads that were written. More than 200. Okay, now, how these things came about? Originally, they were just the very origin of the Vedas was just the first two parts, Samhita and Brahmana, the mantra part and the explanation of the rituals part. Those are the original contributions to the Vedas. Then subsequently rishis added all the rishi. Do you know the term rishi? What's a rishi? Yeah, all the ancient wise men, you can call
them.
Okay, these people who meditated and he gave us all these beautiful texts, that's called, they were known as rishis. Okay, so these rishis added these Upanishads a little bit later. In terms of chronology, the Upanishads are later additions to the Vedas. Okay. And apparently there were more than 200 Upanishads that were added to different Vedas. Okay.
So, do the Upanishad has their own name? How do I know which Upanishad I have? I would tell you, somebody will ask me, have you read Upanishad? I would say, yes.
No, which one?
But there's 200. How do I know?
You have to know when you read the Upanishad, you know which one you're reading. Whether it's the Kathopanishad or the Kena Upanishad or the Mandukya Upanishad, you know which.
Which one am I reading?
But aren't they all organized? Like
they're all mentioned there in the text.
Yes, yeah, so the chapters.
You're talking about those parts. Okay.
Individual chapters will have individual Upanishads.
Got it. Okay.
That's what you will be reading. See?
Okay, but there is one Upanishad, but.
No. The Upanishad is a common term for the text which contains the spiritual knowledge.
Okay.
And there are 200, more than 200 of these Upanishads were written.
Okay.
All right. So, okay. Like you say, a song.
Well, I might be off, but I thought I remember reading something about how the Upanishads, like, they're like there's a huge gap between the Upanishads and the Vedas, and there's books and books and books based off these texts, and then what they put in this book is like just a condensed version of what the most popular books are.
Right? This one?
Yeah.
This is a very, so I'm coming to that. What?
So it's really like several hundred books, right? Or
no, like I said, what they claim is that they were close to 200, a few more than 200 maybe. But then some are extinct. They are not traceable. And what is traceable is listed in one of the Upanishads called the Muktika Upanishad, and they list, and there is a list of 108 Upanishads. So now, when you talk about Upanishads, they say there are 108 available Upanishads. 108. So we know all of them now, all these 108, their texts are available, you can read them, you can understand them, talk about them, discuss them, etc. 108. And they are listed in one Upanishad called Muktika Upanishad. That's the name of the Upanishad, which lists all these 108. Okay. Now, of these 108, there are most commonly known as 10 principal Upanishads. So, what Eknath Ishwaran has done is to take or these principal Upanishads and write a commentary on those Upanishads. Now, how did they become principal? Because many years ago, this was about the 8th century, common era of the, about 8th century. So about 1200 years ago, let's say, there was a big yogi or a spiritual teacher called Shankaracharya. Anybody heard the name? Shankaracharya. Shankara. Adi Shankara. No, okay. Anyway, he was a very renowned spiritual teacher, and he wrote commentaries on multiple things. He wrote commentaries on Bhagavad Gita, commentaries on all the Upanishads, commentaries on many other texts from the past. Many, many texts. And he chose these 10 texts to write his commentary on. And that's why, because he chose them and people believed in him, they started calling those 10 the principal Upanishads. And everything else was called a minor Upanishad. Alright, that's how it is. So my assumption is Eknath has taken the same 10 and then made his commentary on those. Roughly. Okay. So 10 principal. Now there are more recent additions. There are actually some people who claim there are 13 principal because 3 others are considered to contain really very significant information. So they think they are also very valuable. So it doesn't matter. Most of them contain the same thing basically. If you read one, then there are certain variations and very similar knowledge they contain. Now, another term that you might want to understand in Sanskrit is called Shruti. Shruti. Have you heard the term?
Yeah, I don't remember what it is.
Shruti and Smriti.
Smriti, yeah. Well,
so, Shruti and Smriti. Shruti is something that is heard. Smriti is something that is memorized or remembered.
Memory.
Okay. Now,
how do you spell that?
Shruti, S-H-R-U-T-I, Shruti.
And again, what is Shruti?
Shruti is something that is heard. Now, these Vedas and Upanishads, they are called a form of Shruti. Why are they called Shruti? Because these are not considered to be the product of human intellect. So where did they come from?
Yeah.
Right? They are not a product of human intellect. So what they claim is, they were revealed texts, revealed concepts, revealed thoughts, revealed to these yogis in their deepest states of meditation. When they were able to go beyond their intellect, when they were able to go beyond, transcend, that's the deepest part of meditation. When you can transcend your intellect, that's deep meditation, right? You know that. Everyone knows that or no? Meditation, samadhi. Meditation is to transcend your mind, your thoughts, your emotions, your feelings, your intellect, whatever you have. Only then you can get to your true essence of your true being. That's meditation. This is what these yogis did, these rishis, they all did this all the time. They were in deep states of meditation for long, long periods of time, days, weeks and months, they say. So this revelation came to them through pure intuitive wisdom, revealed from whom? From the Supreme God, from the Supreme Being. That's what they called, eventually they started calling that being Brahman. Okay, so this revelation came to them from their pure state of transcendental meditation. And that's why they are called Shruti. But anything that came afterwards, that's called Smriti. Smriti means a product of the human intellect. S-M-R-I-T-I.
Okay. When you're saying in a transcendental meditation, if yogi is saying in sitting in transcendental meditation has this something that repeats and repeats and repeats, how the knowledge comes, eventually that repetition sort of goes away and the idea of the knowledge comes away.
That's right. That's right. Everything has to stop. The repetition has to stop. Everything has to come to its standstill. And this revealed knowledge comes through.
Because I notice when I repeat, then eventually it sounds like music in a background and my mind goes somewhere else and I have to return.
Right. Something like that. But we are not at that stage of...
Right. We are not there yet. Yeah.
But, you know, once you... You know. So these people, that's why they are called Shruti. Then, you know, there are smritis like Puranas and there are even Bhagavad Gita and Mahabharata and Ramayana. Have you heard these terms? Have you heard Bhagavad Gita? Right. They are called smritis because they are produced by human intellect through their own intellectual thinking based on the knowledge that they received from the Vedas, from the Upanishads. Gita, for example, right? It's almost entirely based on the concepts which were given to us in the Upanishads. Plus, you know, a lot of other things have been added there. But taking those concepts from the Upanishads, using the human mind, and then converting that into a very beautifully structured document. All right? The Upanishads, on the other hand, no structure. Because they were kind of revealed to them in haphazard way, you know, some thought will come now, another thought will come now, another thought will come now. Very disjointed concepts will come. And these yogis would reveal these to their students just as they got them. Okay. In those days, no printing press, right? There was no way to print anything. There was no way to write down anything. The only way you could write something was on a palm leaf or something. There was no printed paper or anything. There was nothing to write on. So you had to write on a piece of palm leaf or some other similar object. So the most common way to transmit knowledge was oral, verbal communication.
So how old is Upanishad or Vedas in when you're looking at Sutra? Was Sutra first and then Vedas?
Sutras came later.
Oh, so what is the oldest? Vedas?
Vedas are the oldest.
So Vedas, then Upanishad.
Vedas, Upanishad, then Sutras and all that, right.
So this is more than 5,000 years old.
Well, they say at least 3,000, minimum. Okay. And then 3,000 beyond. Some say 5, some say even say 7 or 8,000. But 3 is what they say, kind of cut off line. Definitely older than 3,000.
Yeah, okay.
And then, you know, so the oral transmission was the only way to really learn things and then continue to propagate them through generations. So these ideas that came to them in a very random, haphazard manner, they were put down in some form, maybe written on a palm leaf or whatever, or transmitted to the students orally. But there were no structure to these thoughts because they were random thoughts. Because they were not organized by human intellect, by the most part. I mean, there are obviously teachers there who tried to do some ordering and some organization. But when you read the Upanishads, you will find that there is no real structure. Some thoughts just, well, random thoughts, you know. And also, the word they use in Sanskrit for philosophy is darshana. They don't use, philosophy has a slightly different meaning. Again, philosophy means creation of the human intellect. In our Western culture, philosophy means something that's created by the human intellect, right? Whereas darshana means to see something, to visualize something, which is visualized only during the deepest states of meditation. That's why it's called darshana. But English translation is still philosophy. Okay.
Thanks, Baba. It's
darshana. D-A-R-S-H-A-N-A. Darshana. I have all these words in my notes. I'm just trying to explain them. Okay. So, in general, you know, in many of the texts you will find not much of logical beginning, not much of logical ending, no real structure, but a lot of different concepts kind of sprued around in different ways. What happened, Mike? Okay. What? You don't have the PDF?
No, I somehow missed it.
Well,
yeah, I
didn't know. Yeah, no, you should get the PDF so that you can look at it while I'm speaking.
Yeah.
That'll help. Okay, so to really understand the Upanishads, you need the help of a guru or a teacher or a commentator, you know, a person who really is familiar with the whole subject, very... the person who is a teacher has to be realized himself. You know, it's not somebody who just reads and understands and explains it, you know. Like, you wouldn't call me a teacher of the Upanishads. You know, I have to be at a much higher level, spiritually and intellectually, to be able to explain the real essence of the Upanishads. Okay? So, you need a person who has really advanced at a spiritual level to explain these things. Because to understand them, you have to be at that level. Otherwise, you cannot understand the concepts given in the Upanishads. Okay? Okay, so Shankaracharya, he wrote commentary on these 10 Upanishads. And I have a feeling Eknath Ishwaran's book has almost all these 10, I believe. Does anybody recognize these names? Isha Upanishad, Kena, Katha Upanishad, Prashna, Mundaka, Mandukya, Taittiriya, Aitareya, Chandogya, and Brihadaranyaka. I don't think you need to worry about these names. When you read these texts, you will know. Okay, when you read. Have you read the whole book or just started reading? Oh, you have?
Yeah. But okay. It's been several months ago since I
finished it. Okay. So,
and one of the things that I think was difficult was it's when you listen to it, there's things that sound like they're complete opposites and can't exist at the same time. You know? And it gets confusing.
It is, yeah.
So I'm glad you're here to explain it.
You know, like I said, some of the concepts there are confusing. I mean, many of the concepts are very confusing.
Yeah.
They're not easy to comprehend. And just takes a lot of contemplation. You know, in terms of understanding something, they say there are three elements involved. I'm digressing a little bit. There is three things involved. Shravana in Sanskrit. Okay, I'm giving the Sanskrit words first. Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasanam. Okay, what is Shravana? Shravana is to listen to or read something, first of all. So you have to first of all listen to a concept or an idea or a philosophy. Listen. Or read, you know. That's the same thing. Take an input from. Then Manana is to contemplate. Having received the concept, either through a person or through reading a book, then you contemplate on it. Try to meditate on it, you know. Analyze pros and cons and try to see if it matches with your own understanding and etc. etc. So Manana. And Nididhyasanam is finally deep meditation and application in your life. So there are three stages of learning, they say, and this is very commonly mentioned in our Vedantic texts, Shravana, Manana, and Nididhyasanam. Okay. Now, for Shravana or for listening or reading, you obviously need the commentary by a very well, trustworthy person, you can call it. Trustworthy. Okay, so the guru has to be trustworthy. Alright. So, these are the. So, after reading that book, do you recognize these names? Isha, Upanishad, Mundaka, and all that? Because those are the names that are in the book. Let me take a quick look at the book. Just one second. Like I said, I read it a long time ago. Yeah, same thing. So it started with Isha, Katha. It's exactly the same sequence almost. Brihadaranyaka, Chandogya, Shweta, Mundaka, Mandukya. Prashna, Kena, Ayatriya. Okay. Same thing. Alright. So, you expect the same Upanishads that Shankaracharya wrote the commentary on. Okay. And again, in general, there are no authors, known authors for these Upanishads, because they were revealed to these yogis. They just put them out. There are names of rishis. Within the Upanishads, there are names of multiple rishis. Okay, so there are stories, you know, they are in the form of parables, question answers, dialogue between student and teacher, dialogue between husband and wife, between father and son, These are the ways and the methods of teaching different people within the Upanishads. Okay, so there'll be many names of rishis that you will come across in the Upanishads. But they are not the authors of these Upanishads. They are just as a part of their of the scripture itself. Okay. So, what is the main theme of these Upanishads? Main theme that you mentioned.
The life, the, how we are supposed to understand death and...
Right, absolutely. What is life, what is death, what happens after death? Main theme is that everything in this world that we know of is transitory. Everything. Nothing is fixed, nothing is permanent. Does everyone get that concept?
Yes.
Everything, whether it is living being, whether it is non-living being, everything is impermanent. This building was not there 100 years ago. It may not be there 100 years from now. Alright? This human body was not there 100 years ago, and it most likely will not be there 100 years from now. Right? Everything is transitory. Everything is changing. When you say there is something, when you say there is movement, when I say there is movement, it is with reference to something. This movement is with reference to something that is not moving. So if I'm saying I'm moving, it's with reference to this floor which is not moving. Everything has a relevance in terms of some reference point. Okay? Can I say this is stationary? This one? This floor? Is it stationary or is it moving?
Well, it depends on how far out you go.
Right.
The earth is rotating and that's part of that. So technically,
right. So, you got the idea, right?
Yeah.
Now, it is rotating along the earth's surface with reference to what? Something which is not rotating. What is that reference? The axis of the earth. That's stationary. Is the axis of the earth stationary?
No, not really. The earth has been around the sun.
Okay.
Everything is moving.
Everything is moving with reference to something or the other. There is always a reference point which has to be there, otherwise we will not recognize motion. So change is always with reference to something which has no change. Otherwise we cannot say there is change. If there is something which is not changing, then only we can say something which is changing. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So in all this changing universe, when the human body, human mind, human intellect, everything that relates to the human, everything that relates to the non-human, non-living, is changing, it is with respect to something which is not changing. Go as deep as you can, and then that something has been given the name Brahman. That's it. What that thing is, we have no idea. Because it doesn't have a shape, it doesn't have a form, it cannot be felt, touched, smelt, seen, visualized, nothing. But we know conceptually that there is something which is changeless, completely changeless, forever changeless. It can have no beginning, because if it had a beginning, it cannot be changeless. It can have no end. It's permanent, forever. It's changeless. And that changeless entity has been given the name Brahman, which is the most basic, fundamental concept within the whole concept of Upanishads. It's a very unique concept. It doesn't exist anywhere else. And you know, they keep propounding that in multiple ways, in every Upanishad. It's the same concept, but given in multiple ways. Okay? What is changing? Everything else is changing. Everything else is changing. This human body is changing. Alright? How does it change? There is this whole concept of reincarnation, rebirth. Everyone familiar with the concept? Rebirth and reincarnation. What does that mean to you? What's rebirth or reincarnation?
To come back to something else. Another life form. Another form.
Say that again?
It's to come back another form, another energy, another life.
What comes back?
Your soul.
Your soul comes back. So now you're bringing another concept here. What's that soul?
Truth is you. Soul is a part of Brahman.
Soul is a part of Brahman. Right? So that's where it all gets very complex, and that's why people have so much trouble understanding these concepts. Because, you know, this whole concept of reincarnation is a very important concept in our culture, in our understanding of these concepts. Okay. In the yoga itself, you know, we talk about 23 elements. I don't know if you recall, we've talked about them many times. It's a good reference to understand what is reincarnation, what goes and what stays, etc., right? What is reborn and what is not reborn? So I'm going to take a digression here and just tell you what from the yoga perspective, because that makes it easier to understand. These things have evolved after, they're not in the Upanishads, but after Upanishads, these things have evolved as a form of yoga practice. In the Sankhya philosophy, they claim that the human being is a composite of 23 elements. Okay, what are these 23 elements? It will be helpful to understand that. So I'm just going to list them very quickly. There's the intellect, human intellect. There's the ego, the mind. These are called subtle elements. Intellect, ego, and the mind. Then there are the five sense perceptions. Sense of smell, sense of taste, sense of touch, etc. Sense perceptions, five sense perceptions, okay? Then there are five sense organs, the ear, mouth, tongue, etc. Ear, nose, eyes, tongue, you get the idea, right? Skin, whatever. Five sense perceptions and five sense objects. Then there are the five, they are called the organs of action. Five organs of action. What are these? Hands and arms for pushing, pulling, lifting, etc. Hands and arms at one. Feet and legs for locomotion, kicking, alright, walking. That's number two. Tongue for speaking, action. And for hurling insults at others. Tongue. I'm just kidding. Yeah.
I'm writing it down.
Okay, those are the three organs of action. Then there are two more. Can anybody guess?
Ears?
Action.
Action.
Ears were organs of?
Sense organs,
yeah. So two more are organs of procreation and organs of elimination. Okay, so five organs of action. So we're up to 18, right?
Yes.
Five more. Guess. They are called the five great elements. Earth, water, fire, air and ether. Everyone heard of those? We are at the very physical gross level. We are a composite of these five gross elements called the earth, water, fire, air and ether. So, according to yoga philosophy, according to the Sankhya philosophy, we are a composite of these 23 elements. Of these, some are called gross. The five gross elements, earth, water, fire, etc., they are called gross. The five organs of action, they are called gross, etc. Subtle elements are the intellect, the ego, the mind. The memory is a part of ego. They don't list that memory as separately. But that has to be understood. Okay? There's an element called memory.
Yeah.
But when they talk of these 23 elements, memory is considered to be a part of ego. Okay? That's how memory is used by the ego. Okay, and then five sense perceptions, senses of touch, taste, etc. So they are all called subtle elements. Okay. Now, in general, the soul, the human soul, which is the pure soul in general, which should be the pure soul, but it's not pure because it is tied with the ego. It gets bound by the ego. Right? Ego has a lot of say in everything. Alright? So the Atma or the soul or the self is confused and it is kind of bound by the ego and all the other memories and samskaras and vasanas and all that stuff. That's called the subtle part of the body. Okay? That's what goes to the next life. Okay? The soul which has been attached to this subtle part of the body, it's a conglomerate of all these things which goes to the next life, gets attached to the physical body in the next life and makes that another next 23 elements. You get the idea now?
Yes.
So that's what reincarnation is, how reincarnation is understood in our yoga concept.
If you said, when it goes to the next life, the subtle body, the ego from the previous grows. You said memory is part of the ego, but in the next life, you lose those memories.
Yeah, you lose the memory, but it's still there in the subconscious at the very deepest level. Yes, that's why we have samskaras.
Right.
That's why some people become Beethoven at the age of five.
Right.
It's because
that
of their
the memory that was
poured over from there, right?
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, some people start playing music at the age of two or three, you know, you've seen some of these videos. You know, and I remember I used to have a friend of mine, at the age of five, he memorized the entire Bhagavad Gita, all 700 verses, at the age of five. He was reciting every single verse of the 700 verses. So
my mom's an old soul. She was reading at age of two.
Hmm?
My mom was able to read at the age of two.
She was able to read at the age of two? See? So these are some of the samskaras. Everyone knows the term samskara?
Yes.
Okay, these are the previous, you know, carryovers from the last life, previous lives and all that. Not just one life, but multiple lives. Okay? So the whole concept of the Upanishads is to first of all proclaim that there is this Brahman, which is totally unchanging, totally changeless, beginningless, endless, which is the reference, sort of reference for everything that's happening in this universe. And then, like Zora mentioned, you know, this Atma, this soul, they claim is nothing but a part of that whole pure consciousness, pure being. But it is confused because of the binding that it has with the... Why is it dying all of a sudden? Okay? So, these words that I've written, it's fit for, I'm just going to read this, the bullet items, just so you know. It's fit for contemplation, concentration, speculation, and philosophical inquiry, not devotional or ritual worship. You cannot get to this Brahman, that the pure consciousness, through ritual worship. That's what the Upanishads say. It's a topic of contemplation. It's unborn, eternal, without beginning or end. It's non-communicable, because we don't know what it is. You cannot communicate about it. It's unapproachable in ordinary state of consciousness. You have to go beyond your level of consciousness, current state, go to the highest level of consciousness, maybe that's when it is approachable. So in the deepest state of meditation, when you don't need the mantra at all, no need to repetition, when you go beyond the need for repetition, that's when you can get an access to these levels of consciousness.
So if you're praying,
if you're praying,
then how are you reaching Brahman if you're asking for something outside of?
Right. So that's why it says, through praying you cannot reach Brahman.
Right. So what are you reaching then?
You're cleansing your mind. Through praying, you're cleansing yourself. You're purifying your mind, because you need a purified mind to eventually sit and meditate and to reach higher levels. It's called, the Sanskrit word for that is antahkarana shuddhi. Antahkarana is the inner instrument, which is a composite of intellect, mind, memory, and the ego. Okay? And these four, they are called the inner instrument. And it's the impurity of this instrument which is causing us not to realize our true nature. So through prayer, we are trying to cleanse ourselves of all the impurities in the mind.
So you're never asking for help from another?
You are. You could be asking for help. You could be asked. Now, there are multiple, again, in the Vedas, that's why people started disliking the Vedas, because all in some of the sections, all they were saying is, if you do this ritual, you know, you will get 100 cows. You're asking for material wealth. Okay? It's perfectly okay, because you need material wealth. But if you want to go spiritually higher, then that's of no use. That particular ritual is of no use. So you do prayer, do a ritual. You can ask for wealth, you can ask for a car or something, whatever. Okay, you may get that. But that's not going to help you spiritually. So if you want to go beyond that, you have to transcend that level of prayer, etc. Eventually, that's why they say prayer is very essential. Because it helps you focus your mind, it helps you, you know, it helps to cleanse your mind, purify the mind. Because you can only do prayer with pure mind. If the mind is impure, then prayer is meaningless, useless.
What do you mean by pure mind?
Pure mind means there is no ego involved.
Okay.
There is no you and I. There is no... Pure mind means that you're not saying that, okay. You know, impure is only purely materialistic. You know, in India, during exam time, every temple is full with students. Every temple. You go there in the morning, hey... Oh God, please, I'll give you this, I'll do this for you. Please make me succeed in the exam. Everyone is doing that. But that's not going to help them spiritually. It's not. It's probably not even going to purify their mind, because they are doing it purely for a very materialistic gain.
So with the idea with quantum physics now and with science and power...
Say that again?
The idea now with quantum physics and science, how we're actually able to see the sacred vibration of all things sort of connected, with instruments now, is the modern or the scientific language for that, we're just all trying to raise that vibration so that we can then be able to be in vibration or harmony with Brahman? Is that the idea? Is that we're just... Is, is
You're asking a question which is beyond my level of understanding, because I don't know enough about the modern science, you know, quantum mechanics and all the string theory, and there are lots of new theories coming up. I don't know enough about them to really understand how they link and how they connect with spirituality. I've seen multiple books written on science and spirituality, but I don't have a feel for what's going on in the field of science. From what I know, there are people, there are scientists who are now trying to understand this consciousness concept. Because in the past, I'm told they were not willing to believe there is anything like consciousness. But now apparently they are trying. Do you know anything more than that?
Yeah, I have read and I've watched and done that, but I mean, I'm not a scientist, so I'm not in the field of study. But for me, they definitely seem like they're linked, you know.
I'm sure they do. I don't know. I don't know enough.
Yeah. It just gets a different framework for words to use. You
yes.
know, like about vibrations and, you know, we're waves and we're just trying to increase our vibrations so that we can actually
connect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So vibrations, when they synchronize, when they harmonize, then they become one.
Yes.
So we are raising our vibration so that we can harmonize with the highest vibration that we're trying to reach.
That makes perfect sense to me. Like that's something that I can visually understand too.
Right. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, they claim that pranayama practices are so very important. Pranayama is all about vibrations.
Yeah, you know.
You know, you all practice pranayama, right?
Yes.
Right? Pranayama is all about creating vibrations through our breath. Okay? And what they claim is that these vibrations eventually go and harmonize with the vibrations in the mind, in the subconscious levels, and then break those patterns which keep us bound to our past. That's how pranayama is supposed to be so helpful in cleansing the mind, because it breaks those patterns which keep us bound to the past. That's it.
So, I know that both is important. Meditation and pranayama is important, no doubt about it. But my teacher, I was meditating every day. I did not have that much time for pranayama, and he told me, I'm glad you're meditating, meditate. But I want you to do pranayama every day. You must do that. Is in your mind, is something more important? In my mind,
this is my own personal feeling. Meditation is more important than anything else.
Okay.
Okay. But Patanjali, in the Yoga Sutra, Patanjali says pranayama is important because pranayama will help you in meditation. Because pranayama is the one which will help you a little more in breaking those patterns which keep you bound to your past impressions. Mm-hmm. And when those patterns are broken, it's easier to meditate and then get closer to your goal. Mm-hmm. So that's why they claim pranayama and meditation are equally important. But if you want to pick between the two, I would still say, stay with meditation.
Okay.
That's my preference.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I do both, so it doesn't matter. You know. I do every day.
I know what you do.
Both pranayama and meditation. That helps. Okay. So, let's go back to this slide here. It says, it's beyond the three gunas. Does everyone know the concept of gunas? What are the gunas?
Yeah.
Go ahead, name them.
Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas.
Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas. What do they represent? Anybody remembers? What is sattva?
Like purity.
Purity, yes. And what is Rajas?
Heat. Fire.
Chaos.
Rajas is movement, action.
Action,
Rajas is action, movement, ambition, that's Rajas. And what is Tamas?
Lethargy.
Lethargy, dullness, sleepiness, you know, negative thoughts. So, but they are all a state that we are all in all the time. We are all in a state where these gunas are in a certain proportion all the time. Okay, and then this proportion keeps changing from one moment to the next, all the time. Alright, so we need to, you know, what it's saying is that this Brahman is beyond these gunas. There is absolutely no influence of the gunas. And to get there, you yourself have to transcend the influence of the three gunas. Then only you can get to Brahman, otherwise you will never reach there. That's the whole concept here. So how do you determine what's Brahman? The word used in one of the Upanishads, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, is neti, neti. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. So what is Brahman? It's not my body. Is it my mind? It's not my mind. Is it my intellect? No, it's not my intellect. Is it my memories? No, it's not my memories. It's my thoughts? No. My emotions? No. What is it? Silence. We don't know. All we can tell you, it's not this.
It's a piece of your soul, the energy.
You cannot name it. That's the whole point they are saying. It's incommunicable.
You know the story I love from you, the one that you said, that you said in that class that you were God and the student walked away?
Right.
That stays with me because you said, and I feel it, like, yes, the power is inside of me, the little fraction of it.
Yes.
Because we all are part of
yes.
that source.
You know, the story that she's reminding me, you know, I was in New Jersey in those days, and I used to teach at my basement, my yoga classes. And, you know, I just, same thing, Vedanta philosophy, Brahman and Atma, soul. So I was just telling them that, look, this is, we are, at the very deepest level, we are nothing but this soul. And this soul eventually is the part of God. So we are, in essence, we have element of God in us. And there were these two students who walked away, right away, from my class. They just walked out. They said nothing. So I called them later, you know, what happened. He didn't say anything. I just called one of them. He said, your statement violated our basic concepts of Christianity. You just cannot say that you are God, or something like that. And I don't understand all those things, so, you know. But in any case, since then I have not made that statement in my class anyway.
It was just misunderstood. Because the meaning, I think, well, anyhow.
And it was strange.
I would think that if you were a Christian, then you would think that you are of God, from God, would have a piece of God in you.
I don't know. And he just
completely...
I've had similar... kind of experiences. One of my very close friends, I used to play tennis with him all the time. And, when I became a yoga instructor, I went to his office. I took my flyer. I said, can you please keep it so your... He was a chiropractor. And he was a good tennis player and good buddy of mine. As soon as he saw that I have become a yoga teacher, he said, I don't want to have anything to do with you.
Why?
See, yoga violates Christianity.
Was he also Indian or was...
No, he was a Christian.
He was Christian.
American Christian.
Ah, yes.
And he was a chiropractor. And as soon as I saw that, he saw that I was a yoga teacher and I brought a flyer, he said, please take it away and don't come near me anymore.
Wow.
He stopped playing tennis with me and just no communication. I don't understand. Yeah.
I don't either. Definitely wasn't physical. What I was raised and taught in church growing up, I don't consider myself a Christian at all, but I definitely was taught to not have judgment.
Right.
So, I actually had experience with family and all that are that fundamental.
Oh, I know.
So you can probably relate with that experience then. Anyway, just an aside. So how do you understand the Upanishads? You know, this is again from one of the Upanishads. It says that you have to approach a guru. Guru is a learned teacher with humility and desire to serve. Not desire to learn, but desire to serve. That's important, they say. Then they say many may never hear of the self. You know, most people don't hear of the self. They don't care. Okay. Many, though they hear of it, they don't understand it. This is where, you know, we are in that category. Most of us, we hear of the self all the time, but we don't understand it. I'm in that category because I have no understanding of that self. But you start speaking about it, you start making an assessment making a statement that you want to learn about it, you want to hear about it. Okay, you're wonderful. Then you start learning about it, you are an intelligent person. That's what the Upanishad says. Intelligent he who learns about it. And finally, blessed is he who is able to understand and explain it further. So you've gone way beyond just curiosity and trying to understand what this is. Alright? So we are here, at least we are talking about it. We're getting a kind of a foot in the water, basically, you know, just getting the feet wet with this whole concept. And then it's a whole vast expanse of curiosity and exploration where we keep working on it and trying to understand these concepts.
So do you have somebody who's like your guru that you talk to about?
That's the, you know, it's a problem. No, you're right. No, I don't have a guru. And
your original teacher, no?
I don't have a real guru that I can approach in a human body form. I consider Patanjali my guru, Yoga Sutras. Okay? That's the only one that's approachable to me. But I've tried to find, you know, a person in the human form to be a guru, but really haven't met anybody who can really satisfy everything that I need. So I keep digging in myself and at my own level. But in my own mind, deep in my mind, Patanjali is my guru. Yeah. Whatever worth, it's worth. Okay, so, you know, Atma is the soul, but it suffers from impact of Maya. Does everyone know the term Maya? What's Maya? Illusion of what?
Separateness.
Separateness?
Or the dwelling.
Yes, duality of what?
Of everything.
Right. Maya is an illusion of duality, you can say, or basically it is thinking something that is impermanent as permanent. Thinking this body is permanent, or thinking this intellect is permanent, thinking his life as permanent, things like that, or this universe as permanent. That's Maya, basically. Because like we said, everything is changing, but we don't recognize that. We see that change, and yet we don't feel the impact of that change. What it should be, right? Alright. But then, the Upanishads, they told us, these four, you know, they are called the great statements. They are called Brahma Vakyas or Maha Vakyas. Vakya is a sentence or a statement. Maha means great. So these are called the four great statements. They have all these scholars, they have picked these four from the Upanishads and they've listed them as the four great statements. What are these four? The first one is you are that. You are that. What does that mean? You are that, not everything, that.
Impermanent.
Specific that.
That is the higher power.
That is the Brahman. at the higher power, higher consciousness, supreme consciousness. And what it's saying is you as the limited soul, you as the limited soul, which you think is limited, you are not limited. You are that. Eventually you are nothing but that supreme consciousness. Okay?
I guess that's what I was getting to, isn't it?
Say that again?
Well, that's kind of where I was going with it. You are that. You're part of all that.
Yes. Yes. Right. Brahman. And then the next one is, I am Brahman. Same thing, said in a different way. I am Brahman. That means my limited Atma is not limited. It's part of Brahman. Brahman is the supreme consciousness. That whole, ultimate being. Then it says, absolute consciousness is Brahman. Okay? Prajnanam Brahman. Prajna is the pure intuition of every human being. Prajna means is intuition. So what it's saying is, when you develop your intuition to that level of superior consciousness, it becomes the same as Brahman. That's what it is saying. I am Atma Brahma, exactly this Atma, this my Atma, this my soul is Brahman. Same thing. So these are the four statements we are called Mahavakyas, okay, or great statements. Vakya is a statement or a sentence. These are the scholars who have later on picked these, and they will be listed in almost every text. Now, some of the significant concepts that are presented in these Upanishads, I have listed them here. The first one in the list is Om. Everyone familiar with Om? Okay. Then the next one listed is five koshas. Is everyone familiar with the five sheets, five koshas? Have you heard these? Do you remember?
Explain it to us.
I will do that.
Confusing. Yeah.
I will do that. I'm just listing them. Then the five pranas, prana, apana, samana, etc. Have you heard of these?
Yeah.
Okay. Then reincarnation. We just talked about that already, reincarnation. And goal of life is to attain liberation or moksha by eliminating ignorance. Ignorance is the cause of our illusion, disillusionment, right? And Atma or the pure soul is no different from the self. It is separate from mind, body, intellect, etc. Then I have listed guidance of a teacher is very highly desirable. And you should think of death as teacher. That's the main theme of Katha Upanishad, Katha Upanishad. Okay?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the last part. Death as teacher?
Death as the teacher, yeah. Because death will teach us exactly what life is all about.
You find out when you get there.
When you...
Oh, gotcha. I knew it. I was wrong. We'll see when I get there.
That's funny. Kathopanishad is all about death. And we'll talk about that. I'm going to spend a few minutes on the Kathopanishad. So, we might run out of time, so let me just speed up a little. So, first of all, Om. Om is a concept which is defined and discussed in the Upanishad called Mandukya. It's one of the Upanishads listed here. Everyone familiar with that? You've read that, right? So, three letters, A, U, and M. What is A? According to Mandukya. A represents what? All our experience in the waking state. A. U represents all our experience in the
dream
state. And M?
Death.
Deep sleep.
I think it's birth, death, rebirth is how they've described it.
Where?
I remember in that book right there.
No.
I thought so. Did you guys read that?
I don't, maybe it is.
I incorporated that into my practice now, like the...
Maybe it is, but, you know, I'm not familiar with that concept. I'm not. I'm talking from the Mandukya Upanishad point of view. This is what they have mentioned in the Upanishad itself. Okay? So, waking state, dream state, and dreamless, deep sleep. And then there is, when you chant Om successively, there is a silence, period of silence. What is that state? What does that represent? That's the state that represents pure consciousness. And then it's called the fourth state. Because they cannot describe it in words, they cannot give it a name. We'll just call it the fourth state. That's what the Upanishad says, Mandukya Upanishad. Om, the word Om or the symbol Om or the sound Om has been mentioned in almost all the Upanishads in multiple ways. So it's in the Katha Upanishad, it's in the Mandukya Upanishad, Mundaka, Aitriya, Brihadaranyaka, etc. They're all talking about Om, very significant sound, very significant symbol. And in the Mandukya, it says Om is everything. That's how it is, Om.
So would the fourth state would be the, when you are accessing really your subconscious, would that be enlightenment? Would that be...
What they say is, these three states, the waking state, dream state and dreamless states, they are changing. Sometimes you are in this state, sometimes you are in that state. Changing with respect to what? Same question. There has to be something which is not changing. Right?
Yeah.
Which is present in all these three states. That changeless entity, which is present in all these three states, that entity which is called the pure consciousness, is represented by that silence between these, the Om chants.
Oh.
It's the observer, it's the seer of all these states which is observing everything and yet not being involved, not changing by itself.
Right.
That's called the fourth state. And in one of the Upanishads it says, Om is the bow, the individual self is the arrow, and Brahman is the target. In Mundaka Upanishad it says that.
That's a great visual.
It's a very nice visual. And you keep that in mind when chanting Om. It will help you get to the final state of consciousness. Okay. Next slide is on five pranas. This again is from one of the Upanishads. Have you all heard about these five pranas at all?
Yes, what is it?
Prana, apana, vyana, udana, samana.
Yeah.
You've heard these terms?
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm. Prana is in, apana is out.
Down, yes. Out, down and out, right.
What is another one?
Prana, apana, udana.
Udana.
Upward. Udana. Udana.
Oh, udiana, manda.
Not that, yeah. Udiana is different,
yeah.
But
it's,
udana.
It's called upward pull.
And it's the one which controls, which eventually controls the final departure of the soul from the body. How does it work? That's udana. Then vyana. Vyana is the one which distributes everything, circulates everything, all the circulation of blood, energy, assimilation of food and all that. That's called vyana. And samana is in the digestion, all the internal fires, you know, when you do Kapalabhati, it works on that samana. Okay, so these are the five pranas. I'm rushing through these, I'm assuming you are somewhat familiar with these,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Five pranas. Then we...
Yeah. It's
a good reminder. I've read all these, you've talked about all these.
Now, five koshas, again, they are mentioned in the text.
So it's five bodies.
Five bodies. What are the five bodies? Physical body first. Physical. Annamaya. Annamaya. Does anybody want to know the Sanskrit words? Annamaya. Let's repeat that.
Annamaya.
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 Yeah. Not Annamaya. Anna.
Annamaya.
Maya.
Are they two ends or one end?
Two ends.
Two ends.
Yes. That's the physical body, which is all the physical structure, bones, muscles, you know, everything that's touch and feel. Okay, that's physical body. That is sustained by food. That's why it's called Anna. Anna means food in Sanskrit. Anna. So sustained by food. Pranamaya kosha, sustained by prana. What is prana?
Breath.
Life.
Breath.
Life force. Breath. So it's the vital sheath, which is all the physiological functions in the body. All the physiological functions, the glands, the circulations, breathing, burping, eliminations, assimilation, all that is part of the pranamaya kosha, physiological function. What's the manomaya kosha?
Say again.
Manomaya kosha.
Manomaya kosha.
Mind. Manas, mind. Mental sheath. What does it have? Mind.
What is sheath? What do
you mean by sheath? Sheath is an enclosure.
Okay.
There are five enclosures. Five layers.
That's an
interesting.
I like that word for that. Makes it less solid.
Okay, so mind has all the other mental stuff, all the thoughts, feelings, emotions, desires, everything. Everyone knows that, right? All the emotions of hatred, jealousy, greed, anger, all that is a part of the mind, right? Ego is a part of that whole concept, mental, okay? And all the samskaras, all the past impressions, etc., etc., everyone knows that. Okay, that's all mind. And that's what makes us, you know, because of the past impressions, we react to situations and events, we react blindly. Right? That's because our intellect is not sharp enough. The next layer is the Vijnanamaya Kosha, intuition, or the wisdom part. So when the wisdom part is active, when we have transcended the mental part, we have transcended the ego, when we can make connection with the wisdom part, then what do? Instead of reacting, we are able to respond intelligently, intellectually. When we react, we are in pain, we are in suffering, we are reacting blindly, and we just don't know what the consequence of reaction would be. We react. But when we respond, we are in control. When we react, we are not in control. Does everyone kind of get a feel for that?
Yes.
Okay. That happens, that respond happens when we are able to connect with the Vijnanamaya Kosha, the intuitive wisdom layer. When we transcend that, then of course we are in the Anandamaya Kosha, which is the layer of bliss. Okay? So these are the five layers of awareness. Five koshas, as they are called. So, in our yoga class, I always say, at least be aware at these three levels, the physical level, breath level, and the mental level, at least three levels. Be aware. And that will lead you eventually to transcend these layers and go beyond those at some point in time. Okay, then I have listed a very well-known peace chant, Brihadaranyaka Upanishada. Asato ma sadgamaya, some of you have heard that. We always chant that in my classes, every class.
I did not know that it comes from that.
See, now you know.
Now I know.
It's from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. In fact, it's in one more Upanishad. It's in the Katha Upanishad also. Both of those. Okay. So what does it mean? Lead me from unreal to the real. From darkness to light, and from the fear of death to the understanding of immortality.
Can you read the top part?
Sanskrit part?
Yes.
You want to repeat after me? Asato ma.
Asato ma.
Sadgamaya.
Sadgamaya.
Tamaso ma.
Tamaso ma.
Jyotirgamaya.
Jyotirgamaya.
Mrityor ma.
Mrityor ma.
Amritam gamaya.
Amritam gamaya.
Om shanti shanti shanti.
Om shanti shanti shanti.
So when we do it in the class, we kind of have a little tune to it. So it goes like this. Om asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amritam gamaya om shanti shanti shanti. Really shanti, that means it really gives you peace when you chant this. Beautiful. Okay? So what's the methodology of presentation in the Upanishads? It's a dialogue. Usually, in most of the Upanishads, it's a dialogue with question and answers. And dialogue could be between, like I said, a teacher and a student. In a Brihadaranyaka, it's between husband and wife. And in a couple of others, it's between a father and a son. Or just going to a teacher and asking questions. Okay? And there are a lot of similes, metaphors, illustrations, and there are a few narratives, episodical, you know, narratives, etc., etc. So these are all the techniques mentioned in the Upanishads. Alright? I've written one bullet here which says the essential message. I'm going to read that to you. The essential message. Actually, why don't you read it loud so one of you can read it? You want to read it?
The essential message of the Upanishads is that there is a changeless reality behind this constant change. The substratum is Brahma. Though it is beyond mind and speech, has no form or shape, is beyond any form of mental conceptualization, the Upanishads tell us with conviction that it can be realized and experienced.
The last part is the most important. Even though you cannot describe it, but you can experience it. When do you experience it? When the mind is 100% still. No thoughts, no feelings. If you're doing a mantra chanting for your meditation, even that mantra chanting has to stop eventually. Even that's a distraction. Okay. So, what I'll do is to switch gears now and then talk a little bit about the Katha Upanishad, you know, which is one of the very popular Upanishads and very commonly read and studied because it's a dialogue. First of all, it has a little bit of a story behind it, so it becomes interesting for people and, you know, it's easier to understand then. Okay. So, the story goes like this, that there was the king, you know, he wanted to do a sacrifice. In the old days, you know, the kings, when they became very rich and very powerful, they would offer a sacrificial offering where they will donate all their, you know, large part of their wealth to the poor and everything. You know, and it was a part of their sacrificial offering to God and to divinity. And this king, Vajasrava, he decided to do this offering and he gave away, you know, a large part of his wealth. And in those days, one of the most important components of your wealth was the number of cows that you had, you know. So, that was wealth, basically. The more cows you have, the wealthier you are. So he gave away most of his cows. But what he found, what this guy, his son, his name was Nachiketa. Okay? Nachiketa was the name of the son of this king. When he was observing, he was a young kid. They don't know how old, they don't tell us how old he was, but most people believe 11, 12 maybe, who knows. What he noticed was that his father was a little cunning in the sense that he gave away cows which were old or they had no more milk left in them, etc., etc. You know, and they gave away all those cows. He was a kind of, he was upset, you know, that if you are really giving up your wealth, you should give away something which is meaningful and useful to everybody, not give away these old and depleted, you know, stuff. So then he goes to his father, you know, that you've done this, I'm concerned, but I want to ask you, when I am old, or who are you going to give me away to? His father says, you are a young kid, you know, get away from here. I don't want to answer this question. He came back and he said, Father, tell me, who are you going to give me away to? He asked him two or three times. The father was very upset. He said, I'm going to give you away to death. Eventually. This guy took it seriously. He said, okay, I'm going to go to death now. Alright. In India, there's a very, in our culture and in the spiritual text, there's a concept of the god of death. Like everything is a god, right? Everything is a god. So there's a lord of death. So the concept is that when you're ready to die, this lord of death comes to you and then he takes your soul away. That's the story. Soul and the subtle part takes it away, and then, you know, then there are other elements which will redistribute that whole being into a different body and all that. This whole concept there. But there's whole this concept of God of death who will come and take that part away. So this guy, this young kid, he says, okay, I'll go to Yama. The God of death is called Yama, Y-A-M-A, Yama. So he says, I'll go to Yama. So he goes to his Yama's house and he knocks at the door, nobody's there. Yama's wife tells him that he is out on a business trip or something like that.
He's killing people.
Mm-hmm.
He's taking the soul.
Yeah, he's picking on people, that's doing his job. He's on a business trip. Now, this guy, this kid, he's a Brahman, a kid. Brahman is one of the highest castes in India. And you're supposed to, when if a Brahman person comes to your house, you're supposed to be very respectful and treat him very nicely, etc. Those are just customs. This kid decides to sit at the door until Yama returns. Alright. One night, two nights, three nights. After three nights, that guy comes back. And then his wife or his servants, they tell him, look, this kid has been sitting here for three nights. He's a Brahmana kid. You should go and, you know, check with him what he wants. And feed him maybe, because he has not eaten anything, he has not had any food, drink, nothing for 3 days. So he goes and chats with the kid, asks him, what brings you here? So he tells him the story that my father, you know, did this, and he's very upset with me, and he says, I'm going to give it to you, so I'm here with you. So Yama says, you know, you are a Brahman and I'm supposed to respect you and all that, but since you have spent three nights here, I'm going to give you three boons. So you ask for three boons, one for each night. So ask for three boons. All right. So he says, okay, I'll ask you three boons. So the first boon he says is that, look, when I go back to my own, you know, when I go back to my earth in my human form, my father should not be angry with me anymore. He should not be upset with me anymore. And he should accept me with peace and happiness. So he said, that's a very simple boon. I grant that. So what's the second boon? So the second boon is, you know, there is a fire ritual that is supposed to be done. And that ritual, when you do that properly, you can attain heaven. You can go to heaven. And there are concepts of heaven defined in Hindu culture, you know, so we will not go into that. Okay, but that's what it is. Okay, he says, I want to learn about that fire ritual which will make me go to heaven. He says, done. Granted, that boon is granted, and not only that, I'll give you another additional boon, that fire from now on will be named after your name, so it will be known as Nachiketa fire. Alright? So everyone who does Nachiketa fire will be taken to heaven. He says, ask me a third boon now. So he says, I want to know if there is anything that's permanent that stays even after death. Now Yama is perplexed. He says, this kid, he's asking a question which is so deep. He says, look, this is a question that even the gods don't understand. They come to me and I have a hard time explaining it to gods. You are a young kid, so forget about this. I'll give you something else. Ask me something else. He says, no. I want to know what happened. Is there anything that remains after death? That's all I want to know. He says, look, I'll give you all the wealth in the world. I'll give you, you know, women to play with when you grow up. I'll give you this and that. The large part of the universe will be your kingdom and all that. There's nothing doing all that. He says, I know all that is temporary. I want to know what stays after death. That's all my interest. And eventually, Yama has to give up. He says, okay. Absolutely, you insist. So that's the dialogue between Yama and Nachiketa, which form the essence of Kathopanishad. And same concept. Okay, so we'll just go through these slides quickly to... That's the whole Upanishad is the answer eventually to that question.
So what was the answer that you said then?
That's what we'll go through now.
Oh, that's what you're going to now?
Yeah.
I was like, oh, my phone died, so I'm not able to call that. We want to know what the answer is.
So, answer is the soul, basically. Answer is the soul which eventually merges with Brahman, and that's the part that doesn't change. But to explain all that, he goes through a lot of different statements and concepts and ideas. Because just by saying that it is Brahman, you know, nobody can understand that. Okay? So there's a concept of, he starts with a very simple statement. This, he says, you have to start distinguishing between what is pleasurable and what is desirable. Shreyas in Sanskrit and versus prayas. So I'm going to read the shloka itself, the verse itself in English. What it says is, the desirable and the pleasurable approach the man. The wise man, pondering over both, distinguishes between them. And the wise one chooses the desirable over the pleasurable. The fool, acquisitive and craving, chooses the pleasurable over the desirable. Okay? So what does it mean? We know what we're talking about, right? Roughly, you have an idea, right?
Well, the ego wanting the now, what is pleasurable now, and the treya is more long term. What is like better for all, or better for future?
Better
not
for
necessarily now.
Right. So ego always wants to pick what is pleasurable. So, you know, a quick example would be, there is a piece of cake sitting there and, you know, and the ego says, go eat it, even though you may be diabetic or you may have a heart condition or you may have some serious health condition which prevents you from having that, but the ego doesn't care. One piece of cake, who cares, you know, it's okay, you know, let's go ahead and do it. Because it is so pleasurable, it is so, you know, tasty for the mouth, that's all you're going after. To satisfy the five sense organs, that's all we're going about. Right? We're not concerned whether it is desirable or not. Shreyas. So, and who decides whether it is shreyas or prayas? That's the pure intellect. Ego is, we know, if the ego is involved, it's going to pick the pleasurable, nothing else. It doesn't know anything about anything else. But the pure intellect, when it is pure, that means it is not influenced by the ego. It is not influenced by the past memories or impressions which carry all the information in our memory bank. Then it can decide what is desirable. So that's what it's saying here. The ego, it seeks the pleasurable. The pure intellect will seek the desirable. And pursuit of pleasurable leads to ignorance and delusion and pain and suffering. But it's easy to attain, like you said, it's easy to attain. It's there right now. It satisfies the current needs. And yet, it is very short-lived and transient. Eventually, it will lead to suffering. Eventually. The pursuit of desirable, it leads to knowledge and wisdom. Okay? It's difficult to obtain. It's difficult to follow. Alright? Sometimes when these things are desirable, you really have to work on it. You have to sometimes work hard to attain something that is desirable. But very long-lasting and eternal. Okay? Now, the soul is indestructible, as they said. The body is destructible. Body will get destroyed eventually. It'll get, like they always say, it'll merge back into the five elements, earth, water, fire, and all that. What is indestructible? The soul. It never dies. The soul is full of mystery. It is difficult to realize. But by yoga, meditation on the self, can one realize Atman, which helps transcend both joy and sorrow. So, the word yoga, that's one of the very early appearance of the word yoga in any ancient text. This happens in the Kathopanishad. Apparently there are a couple of other texts which also have the word yoga, but the word yoga as it is, it appears very first time, or at least in the very early stages in the Kathopanishad. And what it says is that the knowledge of Atma, the soul, is not realized through instruction, argument, reasoning, etc. Okay? It's only through meditation and introspection that you can attain the understanding of Atman by one who lives ethically, is calm and composed, and peaceful within. So if the mind is agitated, if the mind is impure, you cannot get there. Right? That's the whole purpose of yoga, is to calm the mind. All right? It is difficult to realize. One of the statements here, it's in one of the verses, verse number, chapter 1, section 3, verse number 14, I've written here. Arise, awake from the slumber of avidya or ignorance. Approach an exalted, learned teacher to learn how to realize Atman. The path is difficult indeed to cross, and hard to tread. It's as difficult as the sharp edge of a razor. So because it uses the word sharp edge of a razor, it's become a very famous statement. It's quoted many places that the path to enlightenment is very hazardous. It is very, very difficult. Because the ego keeps coming in constantly. Ego will bring you back into the material concept of life. It keeps pulling you back into the object of the five senses. That's the whole point of this, that ego is so strong, it keeps pulling us back, brings us back into the five senses. So we run after the senses. And as soon as we do that, your concept of Atma goes away. There's nothing there. That's why they said that it is the path which is so difficult, it is like walking on a sharp razor's edge. That's how difficult it is. And because of this avidya, because of the ignorance, we are always disillusioned. You know, they always give this simile of a snake and a rope. Have you all heard that simile? Snake and a rope? Everyone knows that?
No.
No? Snake and a rope?
It's been your...
So, you know, you're afraid and you run away, and then you see, you know, somebody with a flashlight comes by and he says, "Why are you running?"
Yeah.
Say, "No, there's a snake lying on the road." So he puts the flashlight on it, it's just a piece of rope, right? And you run away out of fear, and that fear can cause a lot of damage. It's imaginary fear, but yet it can cause a lot of damage. Alright? And how do you get rid of that ignorance? Through light, through wisdom. That flashlight is the light of wisdom and the knowledge, true knowledge. Okay? So that fear is that ignorance that we're talking about. Now, in the Kathopanishad also there's kind of a definition of yoga. I picked it up because we are all yoga practitioners, so, you know, I found it interesting. And the verses, chapter 2, section 6 and 6 through 13, they discuss as yoga as a path to self-knowledge. So the statement is, only when the mind stands still with the five senses controlled, and when the intellect or the power to reason does not waver, it is called the highest path, the path of yoga. So the word yoga has been used there in that context. Okay, so what are the requirements? The mind has to be still, okay, and there is no wavering, no conflict in the mind, no impurity in the mind. Then when you are able to focus with the five senses controlled, that's the path of yoga. So it is very similar to Patanjali's definition of yoga. I just wanted to remind you, does everyone know the Patanjali's definition of yoga? Chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga chitta vritti nirodha. Okay? So yoga by definition is stilling or calming all the fluctuations that are constantly going on in the mind. And what's mentioned in the Kathopanishad is very similar to that statement. And my assumption, this is my own understanding, that because Patanjali Yoga Sutras came much later, he was obviously influenced by the wisdom in the Upanishads, you know, to create his own philosophy of yoga. Okay? And there is also very commonly referenced chariot analogy. Okay? It's the same symbolism which also appears in the Bhagavad Gita. And the symbolism is that, you know, you should really look at yourself as a chariot. And the body is the chariot. The five horses are the five senses. Okay? And the reins that you control the horses by, that's your mind. Mind is the controller of all the things. Mind is the one which controls the five senses, like the reins of the horses. The charioteer, the one is the intellect itself. He's sitting in the chariot and he's the charioteer. And the passenger, you know, the intellect is the one who's really controlling everything. And the mind is the one which directs everything. The mind is the one which says, extend this hand, bring this in, kick this thing, that's the mind. But the one who decides is the intellect. Alright? But the ego is the passenger. Okay? And that's what is eventually trying to decide what's going on. Exactly right. So the body is the chariot, this whole body is the chariot, and it's all controlled by the ego. That's, the whole statement is, ego is the controller, whereas we want the intellect to be the controller so that our five horses, the five senses, can be controlled. They don't run away here and there.
But sometimes ego is the one.
Ego is the one.
No backseat drivers.
What's that?
It's like no backseat drivers.
Right, right. Okay, so this chariot analogy is, like I said, it's in the Bhagavad Gita also. The same analogy is mentioned, repeated there. Same thing. And it's very often quoted by a lot of people just so you understand how the mind and body function. And it's nicely discussed here. Alright? So, I'm on the last slide now. The summary, I'm just going to read here. It's the same thing that we have talked about. Questions that are posed and discussed. Who am I? What is Atman, soul, or the self? What is Brahman? What is Prana? These are the questions that are raised and discussed in the Upanishads. The basic question is, who am I? What's my true identity? Am I this body? Am I my feelings and thoughts? Am I my emotions? Am I my belongings? You know, my position, whatever it is, you know. Is that what defines me, or is there something more, you know, different beyond all that that defines me? What's my definition? That's the question. Who am I? You know, just a quick digression. I'm going for a brief meditation retreat. It's an 8-day retreat. It's in an organization called AHAM. Anybody heard of that? AHAM. It's in Ashboro here. Ashboro, about an hour and a half. So they do an 8-day meditation retreat. And apparently the only question they ask is, who am I? And you meditate on that for 8 days. That's the hardest question. Who am I? So I'm going there next Saturday.
Let us know what you find out.
What's that?
Let us know what you find out.
Well, we are all in the same path, right? Whoever finds out first, let us know. Right? Unless you claim you're not on that path. I'm assuming everyone is on that path here, right? That's why we are all here.
I hope I'm on the right path.
No, that's our goal, is to find out who I am. That's the whole purpose of this yoga study, is who I am. Right? Patanjali in the Yoga Sutra, he says that only when the mind is only when the mind is calm, can I find out who I am? My true identity, my true reality, only when the mind is calm. That's exactly what the Kathopanishad says. Alright? Any last moment questions? Any thoughts? Everyone okay? Alright, let's close with the again 3 ohms, if that's okay with you. Close the eyes. Comfortable. We'll recite Om 3 times again. Inhale. Since I mentioned the peace chant, you know, which I do in my classes, I'm going to sing that anyway. Please just listen in. Okay, we can join the palms together in the prayer position. Unless you want to repeat after me, is that okay? Can you try to repeat after me? Om Asato Ma Sadgamaya. Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya.
Tamaso ma
jyotirgamaya.
I need to see it. Yeah, I can.
Yeah, I understand. Okay. Let's do one word at a time, maybe 2 words at a time.
Yeah.
I'm going to start from the beginning. Okay. Asato ma.
Asato ma.
Sadgamaya.
Sadgamaya.
Tamasoma
Tamasoma
Jyotir
Jyotir
Gamaya
Gamaya
Mrityorma
Mrityorma
Amritam
Amritam
Gamaya
Gamaya
Om Shanti Shanti Shanti
Om Shanti Shanti Shanti
Thank you all very much.